Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement for the museum. This podcast explores the relationship between our guests and a museum collection item or series of items. And for this particular episode, we're celebrating National Archaeology Week, the annual week in Australia marking the work of Australian archaeologists both home and abroad. So I'm especially thrilled to be joined by a friend and colleague, Associate Professor Leslie Beaumont. Leslie is in the discipline of archaeology within the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences here at the University of Sydney, and she is the co-director of the Zagora Archaeological Project in Greece, which I know we're going to talk about, but a very important excavation in Australian archaeological circles. Leslie, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us on Object Matters.
Thank you, Craig. I'm delighted to have been invited.
Yes, it's great to have you along. Firstly, before we start talking about the object, could I begin by asking you about your role at the University of Sydney? What does your job entail?
Absolutely. So, as Craig said, I'm an academic staff member in the discipline of archaeology. And really, my role divides into three different parts. There's the teaching, there's the research, and there's the service. And I'll say a little bit about each of those. So with teaching, I teach archaeology at both the undergraduate and the postgraduate level. And I teach both in the classroom at the University of Sydney. I teach here in the museum, but I also teach our students in Greece. I run with a colleague a program called the Athens Intensive Program. And we take a group of students to Greece and we teach them in situ about the archaeology of Athens and the surrounding area in the 6th, 5th and 4th centuries BC, which is a really exciting program.
And it must be great for students, particularly from Australia, just have that first-hand experience of the topography, the architecture of the landscape.
Yeah, and topography is something you really can't teach in the classroom. You've got to be in it to understand it, and those students come back with a really extraordinary understanding of the physical geography and how it impacts on the development of society in Greece. So they're very lucky in that sense that they have that opportunity, that of course not all of our students join that program. So that's the teaching aspect of it. Then there's the researching and the writing of books, of articles, of chapters on archaeology, particularly Greek archaeology, and also, as Craig mentioned before, I'm the co-director of the Zagora Archaeological Project in Greece. So I do my own field research, excavation, and different kinds of archaeological field work on the island of Andros in Greece, which is something I love. And then there's what we call the service component of an academic's job, and that's very varied. So one of the things, if you like I do internally in my service role, is I'm what's called the honours coordinator for archaeology. So working with those students who go on to do a fourth year in archaeology and themselves research and write an honours thesis. And I'm responsible for overseeing their work for the discipline. I'm also an executive board member of the Australian Archaeological Institute at Athens. Now, for our listeners who are not familiar with that, the Australian Archaeological Institute at Athens is one of a number, I'm trying to remember the exact number now, is it 22 or something like that, foreign schools in Athens who are the national representatives of archaeologists from their home countries in Greece. And those foreign schools, including the Australian Archaeological Institute, are the conduits, the really vital conduits through which Australian fieldwork in Greece operates. Mm. So I'm very proud of my connection, my association, and my work with that institute. I'm also what's called an expert examiner. It sounds very grand. An expert examiner for the Australian Government's Office for the Arts. And what that involves is providing advice to the Office of the Arts on classical antiquities that are under importation into Australia from overseas to ensure that Australia meets its obligation under UNESCO's Convention on Prohibiting the illicit transfer of antiquities.
Stolen antiquities.
So that's a really important role. And then, you know, last of all, but certainly not least important, is what we might call outreach. So things like this podcast, and then come October, I'll be giving a public lecture for the Tom Bass Memorial Lecture, talking about the background of ancient Greek sculpture on the development of modern Greek sculpture, the links between past and present, if you like. So in a slightly large nutshell, that's it.
Enough to keep you busy.
Yeah.
Well, could you explain to our listeners a bit about your background and your research interests? I mean, what brought you to Sydney?
So I was, as you can probably tell from the accent, I grew up and was educated in the UK. I did a Bachelor of Arts in Ancient History and Archaeology at the University of Birmingham, so that love of the past was there from quite early on. And then I went on to enrol in a PhD in Classical Archaeology, Greek Archaeology at University College London. And it was really at that point that I think the trajectory of my current career was set, in that I did not get a scholarship from the British Department of Education to do my PhD in the UK. What I did get was a scholarship from the Greek government to go to Athens, to be based at one of the foreign institutes, the British School at Athens, and to do my research there. And, you know, crazily, it seems to me now, looking back, I kind of thought, oh, really? And I went to Greece because I didn't have money to do my studies elsewhere, and I fell in love with Greece, not just ancient Greece, modern Greece.
Yes.
And I think had I not done that, the passion that I have for what I do, the connection between past and present would not have developed. And Greece is still my favourite place on earth to be. So that was a really important moment. And I later on, subsequently to getting my doctorate in classical archaeology, I became the assistant director of that foreign research institute at the British School at Athens. And I say that I've been moving south and east all my life, from Britain to Greece. And then in 2000, I took up this job as a lecturer in archaeology at the University of Sydney. So I reckon if I'm going to carry on in my present form, or true to my present form, I've got to go probably back down the bottom and round the top and start again, because I can't really go that much further south and east at this point. There's New Zealand. Yeah, that's true. There's one last bit I could go. And my research interests, you asked about, probably clear by now that my first passion is Greek archaeology, and especially the archaeology of the northeast, Aegean, the island of Chios, where I used to co-direct an archaeological field project at a place called Kadophana, a sanctuary of Apollo, Phaneos, that was in use for many, many, many centuries. Also, the archaeology of the Cyclades, those are the islands that lie between modern-day Greece and Turkey, and Craig mentioned earlier on that I'm co-director of the Zagora Archaeological Project. Well, Zagora is a very important site, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, on the island of Andros. And then the other thing that I'm heavily involved with in terms of research is the archaeology and social history of childhood, particularly the archaeology and social history of childhood and adolescence that I'm now moving into that area in ancient Greece. So those are really my three main areas of concentrated research.
And what are the current projects you're working on? I mean, associated with all three, I'm assuming.
Well, yes, I'm still in the final publication phase of the Kadophana Archaeological Project on the island of Chios. And I just actually like at this moment to pay a little homage to my co-director of that project, Aglaia Akhundidou Argyri, who was the EFOR, or the director of antiquities, for that part of the Aegean for many years. And she very sadly passed away a few days ago.
Oh, I'm very sad.
Yeah, that was unexpected news. So Aglaia, I'm thinking of you and paying homage to all that you did in that part of the world for archaeology. So I'll miss her very much in completing the publication of that project, but we will finish that. And I'm also currently involved in another field project, the Zagora Archaeological Project. That's a settlement site that was occupied between about 900 and 700 BC, a very important site, not least because it's preserved in its, essentially in its entirety. Okay, it's fragmentary, of course, no ancient site is preserved completely intact, but nothing's been built on top of it, which is absolutely extraordinary for an archaeological site. As
and
you know, Craig,
Greece,
because you work on a site that that's got many, many layers of subsequent occupation on it, and Zagora doesn't, and that's extraordinary for what we can understand about the site. And it was just in January this year that, after unfortunately a number of years, 3 years, in not being able to get back to the site because of COVID and all the restrictions that that brought to all of us, I went back with one of my co-directors to the island with our industry partner in tow, because we wanted to go there with him, Nick Kariotoglou of Argos, here in Sydney, in order to discuss collaborative research that we'd like to be able to get back into at the site next year.
So the next steps in the
project. Yeah, the next step. Yeah. So that was wonderful, you know, sort of that hiatus is over and we can move forward.
Yeah, very exciting.
It is very exciting. And the other project that I'm working on at the moment, I've done a lot of work over a good many years. It was actually the area I did my PhD on many years ago, the archaeology and social history of childhood. But that has really dealt in large part with infants and younger children. And what I'm now getting involved with is the archaeology and social history of adolescents, which brings a whole host of different questions with it. And I think the need for new methodologies, and that's what I'm exploring. And I won't go into that too much, but just suffice it to say that it includes bringing into the picture some really current breakthroughs that have been made in neurodevelopmental psychology and what we can understand from that about what the lived experience of adolescence might have been in antiquity.
Look forward to seeing the results of that
research. Yeah.
Well, look, moving more towards materiality, as a lecturer and a researcher, how do you engage with the Chow Chak Wing Museum's collection? I mean, how important is the museum's collection to your research and your teaching?
Well, look, the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection is fundamentally important to the teaching I do. I started teaching classical archaeology during my days as a PhD student in London, and of course we had the British Museum on the doorstep, but also really importantly we had a cast collection, a collection of plaster casts in University College London, which I absolutely exploited in teaching with the students, because no museum in the world, even the Louvre, the Vatican, the British Museum, no museum can have pieces from every era and every style of development of material culture. So cast collections are wonderfully valuable. So I started that work using original artifacts and casts with students many years ago, and that's continued very much into my work here with students. And of course, it's even more important here in Australia, because many of our students have not been to Europe, have not had the benefit of visiting in person the great collections of the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, or the Acropolis Museum, or the British Museum, or whatever it is. And what we have here in Sydney at the Chow Chak Wing Museum is a wonderful, wonderfully diverse collection that brings the past alive to them in a way that simply looking at images in a book or on a screen doesn't.
Yes, yeah.
And
the three-dimensionality of the objects as well, too.
Absolutely. And the scale.
Yes.
You know, when you see something in a book, even if it's got a little scale in the corner, you don't actually appreciate the miniatureness or the monumentality of the object that you're looking at, and working with the objects gives you that. And the Chow Chak Wing Museum not only has so many of these original objects, but it's also got casts that allow us with the students to talk about objects that the originals are thousands of miles away in Europe. So that is something irreplaceable for our students here in Sydney. So from a teaching perspective, it would be really hard to do what I do without access to this collection. And in term time, I use it on a weekly basis with the students. With the research, there are aspects of the collection that, of course, have been more relevant to my research than others. And I was listening to a podcast you did recently, Craig, with Alice Cannon.
Oh, yes.
And she was talking about the Coeys, and I thought, oh, she's talking about my objects. I was very possessive, very, very territorial about them, because if any of the listeners heard that that excellent podcast, it was about two little jugs in the collection that have images of children on them.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that they exist in their thousands in collections across the world, But they're very important for our understanding of particular aspects of infancy in Athens. It has to be said, particularly in Athens. So there are particular objects in the collection that have a really direct connection with my research. And, you know, in a wider context, the work that I do on Andros and on Chios, we've got material from those parts of the world in the collection here, which are great for referring to.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, as I said in the introduction, we're recording this during National Archaeology Week. Can I ask, from your opinion, why is archaeology so important? And what would you like our listeners to understand about archaeology's relevance in 21st century Australia?
Absolutely. Well, look, one of the really important aspects of archaeology is that it can tell us things about our human past and how we've got to be where we are now, in a way that other sources of evidence can't. So we have lots of, for many of the periods of human history, whether we're talking about recent or more distant parts of our human past, we have documentary records and written records. But there are sections of society that no author, until really very modern periods, is going to be interested in writing about.
Yeah.
And this is particularly relevant to my own research.
Children.
Yeah. You know, there is no ancient writer who wrote about the daily lived experience of children. It wasn't of interest to those writers, most of whom were male and most of whom were from the elite classes. Yeah. So what we understand about childhood in certainly the period that I study, so much of it comes from the ancient archaeological evidence. And the same can be said of other marginalized groups within society, and indeed within much later periods of history. So whether we're talking about women or whether we're talking about slaves, you know, those are not, until very, very recently, those are not groups. They're excluded groups. So we get access to these groups, to that history of our humanity from archaeology. And as human beings, you know, understanding where we've come from is, I think, a fundamental curiosity, interest, and importance to us.
Well done.
Convinced?
Yes, sign me up. So, look, Object Matters, the podcast, it's time we turn to the objects. Mm. Could you let us know what object from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection you've chosen for us today to discuss?
Indeed. So I have chosen a piece of classical sculpture. It's called the Nicholson Hermes. It's called now, at least, the Nicholson Hermes. And it's got an accession number if anybody's going to be going onto the website and searching the Chow Chak Wing Museum online catalogue, which is a wonderful resource, I have to say. Its accession number is NM35.120. And it's a piece of classical sculpture, life-size or slightly over life-size, that depicts the ancient god Hermes.
I must say, I'm actually surprised that no one to date has chosen the so-called Nicholson Hermes as the object. So I'm very, very pleased that you have, because I've been looking forward to discussing this one. But why did you choose it? You know, what drew you to it? You could have chosen one of the objects associated with childhood.
I could, but I chose this one for several reasons, probably three reasons. I chose it, I think, because of familiarity, because, you know, every year in working with my students, we use this object.
Yep.
We discuss this object. And I think the more I've worked with the students on it, the more fascinated I've become with this object or by this object, because I've learned, you know, teaching is learning.
Yes.
It's not just about students learning, it's about the teacher learning, very much so. And what I've come to understand and love about this object is the complex history, the complex association it has with the past in the present, because I'll probably say a bit more about this later, but it's not simply an object that was created at one point in time.
Yep.
Yes, it was. It was fashioned by a sculptor at one moment in time, but its genesis and its influences and its really ongoing history have hundreds and hundreds of years behind it. So it's a really fascinating object in the way that it was created, influenced and I think continues to influence sculptural creation today. And then the other reason I've chosen it is because it has an indirect association with the island of Andros.
Yes, well, we'll come and talk about the connection with Andros in a moment, but let's describe it a little bit. You're right, it's an incredibly iconic object, but I think one thing that you perhaps don't appreciate till you see it in the flesh is actually how damaged it is, which is, you know, here we have a classical form, the heroic male nude and contrapposto pose, sort of all of the classical tropes of classical art, and yet it's still quite damaged on the surface as well, and that beauty shines through, and I think that a lot of the ways we can engage with it shines through despite that damage. Yeah, describe it to our listeners.
So it's, as I say, it's a life-size or over, slightly over life-size statue of a naked male figure, as Craig said, in the sort of typical contrapposto pose. Contrapposto is when the weight is shifted. It's a standing figure. The weight is shifted onto one leg, which means that the other leg bends at the knee and the hips, as a result, are depicted at different levels as the weight shifts between the two limbs. It's made of marble, and it's, as we're looking at it essentially, as you probably come into it and look at it in the museum, your first view will be frontally, but he's not looking directly at us.
No.
He's looking off to one side, so he's looking past us. So there's a kind of ethereal quality to it, because you're kind of, oh, what's he focused on? What's he looking at? What's he thinking about? His arms are broken off at the lower forearms, so the hands are missing, but it's clear that one of the arms would have been resting on his right hip. One of the hands would have been on his right hip. And the other arm has a cloak, a traveler's cloak, wrapped around it. And he was probably holding his symbol of authority, what we call the caduceus, his herald's wand, his messenger's wand.
And part of the visual hand. Iconography that would have allowed the original audience to recognise which god it was, particularly for a predominantly illiterate audience as well, too. So that the power of visual messaging.
It was clear, He's also lost his legs below the knee, so we don't know his precise full original height. And the other damage that Craig is referring to is particularly visible on the front of the figure, where you can see striations running sort of diagonally from sort of upper left to lower right. If you go around the back, interestingly, if you come to the museum and do come to the museum and walk around him, go around the back of Greek statues. Not only are they very beautiful from the rear side, but also it's interesting that with this one in particular, that damage is not so visible on the back, which we'll probably come to when we talk about where he was found.
Yes. We've had generations of school kids and generations of university students look around the back and giggle at it, but it's actually a vitally important skill in terms of observation, because you can figure out how it was positioned when it was found, can't you? Yeah. What's he made from?
He's made from white marble. I don't think, and Craig will correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think any stone analyses have been done so that we can precisely understand the quarry that the marble would have come from. But there are many, many sources of white marble in the Mediterranean. This one was probably from a mine in Turkey, one would think.
It does seem to be eastern, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you talked, or you alluded to before, in terms of it being part of a much longer narrative, but when was this statue made?
This particular one was made during the Roman period. Again, can't be 100% certain, but probably the 1st century BC, 1st century AD. So it would have been sculpted in that period, but yes, it fits into a much longer history.
Well, we'll come back to this, but again, already a Roman carved sculpture, but alluding to this long history of Greek art as well. Jumping ahead of myself, what was its function? Because I think people often assume that Greek and Roman statuary is just to be beautiful, but of course there's a whole rationale behind the construction and erection of statues like this. What would have its function been in its original context?
Well, again, we can't know for sure, because when we get to talking about where it was found, it wasn't actually found in its original context. So we don't know where it was erected. Don't know for sure where it was erected. However, there is a parallel statue, a very similar statue. And with that one, we know that this very, very similar in appearance, in form, statue of Hermes was found as a grave marker.
Yep.
So it was erected above a grave. And Hermes, one of his functions, as I mentioned before, he is the herald, the messenger of the gods. And one of his functions as herald and messenger was to conduct the souls from the world of the living to the world of the dead, particularly putting them into the care of Charon, who would take them over the river Styx to the underworld. So it makes perfect sense that the Hermes from Andros, that looks very much like this one, would have stood above a grave, and we've got that information. So it kind of by inference, we think that probably, but we can't be certain, that this statue, this Roman statue, may well have come from the context of being a grave marker. But by the same token, it could have been in somebody's house. You know, it could have been in a very rich individual's house on display, advertising their love for ancient Greek sculpture, for the classical past.
And it's worthwhile bearing in mind how part of, yeah, that sense of Roman display, but in a way that's sort of a contemporary, you know, somewhat of the 1%, somewhat of elite society today will fill their houses with high-value artworks.
Yeah,
this was a Roman sense of representing how well-educated, how well-travelled the owner of the house was, the paterfamilias.
All those cultural references.
So you talked about it not being in its original context. Where was the statue found?
So what we know about where it was found originally was that it was acquired by Sir George Macleay, who has a very important part in the history of the Chowchat Wing Museum's collections, because part of the collections were begun by him, but particularly the natural history.
Yes, part of the Macleay family, who, out of Elizabeth Bay House here in Sydney, amassed this very significant collection of natural history and scientific instruments as well.
However, George Macleay clearly wasn't just interested in collecting natural history, because we know that he acquired this piece in Smyrna, or we now call it Izmir, which is today one of the main cities of Turkey. I think it's the third largest Turkish city on the western coast of the Turkish mainland. Now, in antiquity, that area, that central west coast of Turkey, was part of an area we call Ionia. The ancient Greeks called it Ionia. And it was, in the ancient Greek period, it was settled by Greek people, and then, of course, it became part of the Roman Empire. So we understand that he acquired this piece in Izmir, in Smyrna. We don't know precisely where it originated in Izmir, in Smyrna, but if we go back to that water damage, those striations running down the front of the statue diagonally that we can see there very clearly, you'll see it when you come to the museum, that water damage, which is on the front of the statue but not the back, indicates quite clearly that it had been subjected to running water over many, many, many years. So it looks as though it had lain in a watercourse, a stream or a river.
Yeah, creek bed.
You know, seasonal river, with its backside nicely protected, because its backside was bedded in the river or the watercourse bed, but the water was running over the front. So it, you know, maybe it was adjacent to an ancient cemetery, who knows? But that's what we know about where it was found, in a watercourse in Smyrna.
And in the late 19th century.
In the late 19th century.
So how on earth did it get into the Chowchat Wing Museum collection here in Sydney?
I know, and it's come a long way.
It's come a long way, but of course it's also come via London and via the connection of Sir Charles Nicholson.
That's right.
George Macaulay's good friend.
That's right.
How does he fit into the story?
That's right. So George Macaulay acquired this piece in Smyrna in the 1870s, and I think it was perhaps about a decade later, he was such a good friend with Sir Charles Nicholson that he gave it. He gave the statue to Sir Charles Nicholson. Mm. Now, Sir Charles Nicholson, who has a very big part in the creation of the antiquities collection of the Chow-Chet-Wing Museum, was a British, was born in the UK, and he came to Sydney in 1833 when he would have been about 25 years old. And he was a doctor by training, a physician, and he practiced as a doctor here in Sydney, but he also acquired land, became a landowner, and became a very successful businessman. And subsequently, he entered politics here in Sydney and became Speaker of the House. Now, he had a great love. You know, he's a real sort of Renaissance man, as you can begin to understand all these different aspects of his interests. And he had a great interest in the classics, the ancient literary sources, Greek literary, Greek and Roman literary sources, and in ancient material culture, antiquities. So he became a collector. And he became instrumental both in the founding of the University of Sydney. He was one of the first members of the original Senate of the university. But he was also instrumental in the creation of an antiquities teaching and research collection for the university. Mm. And when he had his own collection of antiquities that came to the university, and then subsequently his sons, after his death, bequeathed other of his items from the UK that he'd had in his collection in the UK. So that's the connection with Sir Charles and how this particular statue came to the university all those thousands of miles away from where it began.
But it's also, I mean, it's an interesting example of his lifelong dedication to the ancient Mediterranean world and Egypt, in that the initial benefaction to the University of Sydney took place in 1860. This is an object found a decade after that, comes into his possession later in the century, and then ultimately is donated to the university by his sons in recognition of his contribution to Australian society. But it's an ongoing process of interest and collection and passion
for the past. Of course, you know, before we got this wonderful new museum, the Chow-Chet-Wing Museum, the antiquities collection of the university was called the Nicholson Museum. Yeah.
And it's still part of the Nicholson collection.
That's right. So it still bears his name.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow-Chet-Wing Museum. My guest for this episode is Associate Professor Leslie Beaumont.
So what's the place of the Nicholson Hermes within the broader context of Hellenistic and Roman art? We've already alluded to that. Long history. How would you explain that?
Yeah, so it goes back to the 5th century BC, so the high classical period that we tend to automatically think of when we think of the splendour of ancient Athens and the triumph of ancient democracy and so on. And it was in that period, or perhaps slightly later in the early 4th century, early to mid-4th century BC, that a very famous sculptor was at work in Greece. And he was a man called Praxiteles. And he created a very famous sculpture that showed the god Hermes carrying the infant Dionysus, because Hermes was very important in protecting and delivering the baby Dionysus, who was under threat from all kinds of forces, and delivering him to the nymph so that he'd be safe and he'd be able to grow up and grow to maturity. And so Hermes was depicted by Praxiteles carrying this baby, and it was a very, very famous ancient statue that was erected at Olympia, and it was erected in the Temple of Hera at Olympia. And that is where it was found. So if you go to the Archaeological Museum at Olympia, you can see the original of this statue. And although there's been great debate over the decades by scholars, is it the original? Is it a copy? Is it the original? Is it a copy? We're pretty sure now it is the original. So that is the original source for this image that was created in 1st century BC, 1st century AD by the Romans. But it's not that simple, because as the centuries went by, so we've got the 4th century BC, and then as we come into what we call the Hellenistic period, after the death of Alexander the Great, so in the late 3rd and 2nd centuries BC, sculptors were so impressed by this Praxitelean figure of Hermes that they began to copy it.
Yeah.
But what we mustn't forget is that ancient copies are not like modern copies. They're not exact.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they all have to be done by hand.
Yeah.
And also, it was up to the sculptor's own artistic license, yes, or indeed the commissioning, whoever had commissioned it, the state or the individual who commissioned the sculpture, to vary the sculpture. Yes. So as these copies, many copies of this original Praxitelean figure began to become created, the baby disappeared from some of them. And the image of Hermes slightly changed, but there is enough strong similarity for us to associate the copies with the original. And then the Romans come along, and the Romans, who are such Philhellenes and love ancient Greek culture, particularly sculpture, then take to copying the copies of the original.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, you get this extraordinary influence coming through, yes, so many.
Not to mention also moving often from Greek bronze originals into,
yes,
Roman marble, yeah, copies. So there's a change of, yeah, materiality. Yeah.
I mean, this is an unusual one, because we know the original was marble, but that's more unusual, because often the original Greek sculptures were bronze and then they were copied by the Romans into marble.
Yeah.
And so they change also in the way that they have to be put together as a result. So, you know, we've got these strands, these threads that connect us back to the 4th century BC, but are constantly evolving and changing, yeah, and carrying the past into the present and the future.
So it's a transmission by inspiration more so than by imitation, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It is. So it's a fascinating piece, because it's a copy of a copy of a copy of an original.
Yeah. But of course, I mean, you know, I often do this with the school kids, you know, get them to pose and so on, because the contrapposto pose then has influenced the way that Western art into, absolutely, the Renaissance and later periods has defined, absolutely, our idea of beauty in the human form, and, absolutely, then the way that, you know, modern artists have often reacted against it, such as a Picasso or a Henry Moore figure. But, you know, the way that models today on catwalks pose and stand, yeah, is still, yeah, influenced,
exactly,
by that.
We live
yeah, we live with Greek art every day without us necessarily realizing it. With Hermes, I mean, his usual attributes that we see associated with him are things like the caduceus you mentioned before, and the winged sandals and so on. What I find interesting is, of course, none of those appear on this. So again, how do we know it's Hermes?
Well, who knows? They may have been there originally, but as you say, they're gone, because the feet have gone and the hands have gone. But it's the connection with the similarity between this figure and other copies that have been made that still have some of these, what we call, attributes,
yes,
with them,
yes,
that allow us to make that inference,
yeah,
that he probably would have been holding these. And he's also, he's wearing a traveller's cape, or he's got a traveller's cape draped around his left shoulder and his left arm, his left forearm. Mm. And he is the traveller, the archetypal,
yes,
traveller. So it is inference, but there's enough there for us to reasonably suggest that this is who it is.
Now, you've already talked about the statue from Andros. I mean, what condition is it in?
It's in a better condition than
this
one.
It
is. It's in a much better condition than this one. It's not as fragmentary, and it does have some of those attributes still intact with it. So it's a very useful piece, because it's probably the closest in style to this one that, yeah, we've got.
And while your own field work and that of the university and that of the Australian Archaeological Institute at Athens, the field work in Andros is, of course, considerably earlier than,
yeah,
the period in which this statue, yeah, was conceived and then the Roman copy of it was made. But how does that excavation at Zagora fit into the bigger picture of understanding Greek culture?
So the settlement site at Zagora on Andros was, I think I said before, occupied between about 900 and 700 BC. And that is a period that we refer to as archaeologists as the early Iron Age. And it's the period that is the precursor to the great zenith, if you want to call it that, of classical Greek political development, culture, and so on.
Yep.
And understanding that period is much more difficult than understanding the high classical period of the 6th, 5th, 4th centuries BC, because it's a period during which we have very few written sources, because that period until round about 750 BC was a period during which writing was not in use in Greece. And even when it does come back in the 8th century BC, of course, it's not being used to record political history. So it's places like Zagora that can give us the archaeology where we don't have the written sources. Now, this is why one of the reasons why archaeology is so important, because we're not dependent on the written word. It's that period that we can begin to unpack and understand through the material culture. And Zagora, as I mentioned before, is particularly important in this respect, because usually when we're dealing with these very early sites, you know, with this we're talking about a site that's 3,000 or so years old, we usually are dealing with only being able to look at tiny little pockets of evidence that we can access among modern buildings or the traces of later built structures that have been imposed subsequently. Zagora is extraordinary in that once that site was abandoned around about 700 BC, it was never again occupied, or at least only for shepherd's huts or something like
that. So no chance of your team ever finding another statue of Hermes on it then?
No, I don't think so. Although, no, I shouldn't say that, because, no, I'm actually not telling the truth, because we know that in the 6th century BC, a temple was built on top of the ancient settlement. Yeah. So we could actually find another statue probably not Hermes, but of somebody on that site. So, but that is the only example we know of a later structure being built on it, but still very much within that pretty early period of occupation. So it's a unique site for understanding that early part of Greek history.
And a very important site.
Yeah.
Bringing it back to the Nicholson Hermes, have you found your response to the object has changed in the way that you teach with it, the way that you engage with it just as a casual visitor to the museum?
It is that sense. When I first came to Sydney and first started teaching students and using this object, I really hadn't myself understood and mined the threads of history that connect this particular piece from the classical period through the Roman, and as you say, Craig, its influence and influence of statues like it on much later Greek and modern sculpture. And it's been that fascination of, I won't call it continuity, because it's the presencing of the past with a new twist every time. So every generation, if you like, reinvents the past. And it's that fascination with the connection of different eras that this statue has allowed me to unpack. And it was very much, you know, the same sort of thing, now I'm going to think about it, the very same sort of thing why I fell in love, one of the reasons I fell in love with Greece when I had that scholarship when I was a student, because I suddenly saw connections between the ancient past and modern society, not continuities necessarily, because, you know, continuity often requires that things don't change. And of course, human society changes all the time and adapts. It's the adaptations, but it's the fascination of the adaptation of social and material culture that serves every generation anew that I think is what I've come to understand about this statue over the years I've been working with it and teaching.
That's fascinating. Thank you, Leslie. Now, not meaning to put you on the spot, but the question that everyone who appears on the podcast gets asked is this one. If you could choose one word, any one word, to describe your connection with the statue, what would it be?
Oh, my goodness, I was dreading this question because it's hard to sum it up in one word. So how would I sum up what I've just said in one word? Can I have three?
Which yes. I think would be, you're welcome.
The thread of history.
The thread of history. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So, look, obviously, it's a work of art which is on exhibition. It's currently displayed on the bridge on level 3. It's one of the first things that visitors to the museum will see. It does dominate the scape. So when visitors come to see it in the flesh, what would you like them to think about while they're admiring the statue?
I'd really encourage visitors to think about it on different levels. So, you know, it is a beautiful object. Aesthetically, it is a beautiful object, and it does. It hits you in the eye as you walk in through the museum, through the entrance doors. You can see it standing opposite. So enjoy it aesthetically, and don't forget to walk around the back and look at it from the back as well as from the front and from all angles. But I think I'd also encourage visitors to reimagine it in their mind's eye, because one of the things we haven't talked about that perhaps I can include here is that ancient sculpture was painted. And of course, those paint traces have eroded as the years have gone by. But if you can look at this statue and picture it in your mind's eye as having hair that was colored, who knows, did he have blonde hair? Did he have brunette hair? His drapery, his cloak, would have been perhaps blue or red. His, not put too fine a point in it, his pubic hair would have been coloured, and probably his skin would have been given a reddish tint to indicate the sun-kissed hue, as I might call it. His lips would have been coloured red, and his eyes would have been, they're empty and hollow now. But he would have had a much more vivid presence, even more vivid presence than he does now. So put that colour back and then think about the mythology behind him, his significance for the ancient viewer. You know, he was the conductor of souls, and if he was found in a cemetery, as we've surmised, his original function. And then think about all the threads that connect him to hundreds of years of history before he was even made. So not a simple object.
Not at all. Thank you for unpacking the Nicholson Hermes with
us. You're welcome.
Leslie, that's been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us on Object Matters.
My pleasure.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chow Chak Wing Museum wishes to acknowledge the traditional custodians of these lands, air and sea, and to pay our respect to the traditional custodians of the past and present.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.